Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The latest hit on the Everything Is Love album by Beyoncé and Jay-Z has gone viral for more than the musicality. The accompanying video has attracted more than 44 million views in just 2 weeks. Notable is a setting for the video, the famed Louvre, which the Carters rented for some $17,000 and a bit of fame to tell a story of sorts about the inclusivity and exclusivity of largely white Western art spaces. Not only are the works of art largely focused on white faces at the Louvre, but visit any mainstream gallery and you're likely to find few, if any, people of color at your side. Coming up, two top Columbus art curators talk about how they're trying to change that paradigm. Culture writer for Vox, Constance Grady, wrote about the video and its message. We'll post a link to her article at WOSU.org/allsides. Constance Grady joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You call it Beyoncé's, quote, surprise joint album with Jay-Z. First of all, just tell us about the album, why you say it's a surprise, and kind of set the scene for us.
So this album was dropped without any notice or warning or ad campaign coming before, which you might remember Beyoncé's done before, right? In 2013, she released her self-titled album, Beyoncé, without a word. A few of her fans noticed that there were new songs by her on iTunes, and that's how the news kind of trickled out to the rest of the internet. And it was something that at the time had kind of never really been done before. So it was this big, shocking kind of power move that she didn't need to invest in an ad campaign in order to make such a giant splash and change the music world. This is Beyoncé kind of doubling down on that move, saying, I'm going to drop a surprise album again, and this time I'm going to do it with my husband, who is also a superstar and also incredibly famous.
And they do it in a really incredibly famous place. At least this video takes place there at the Louvre in Paris. It's a beautiful video. The dancers are magnificent. A casual viewer would be swept away by that alone. How many times have you watched it, and how has your impression of the video changed over time?
Oh, my gosh. I watched it quite a few times, partially because I had to write about it. And I remember seeing it and thinking immediately, this is so Beyoncé, because she has been drawing so much recently, not necessarily just in her music, but in her social media and in the photo shoot she does. She's been really drawing a lot from the iconography of Western art, right? Her pregnancy photo shoot, when she announced that she was pregnant with her twins, in this very lush, artistic series of photos on her website, had a lot of references to Botticelli's Venus and various Madonna and Child paintings from the Renaissance. When she performed at the Grammys in 2017, she had like a Last Supper tableau at one point. She was dressed like a Madonna. Madonna, the artistic figure, not Madonna, the other pop star. So as soon as I saw it, it fell so comfortably into what she's been making her artistic project lately, but it's also moving it forward and advancing it in such completely interesting ways. I think Beyoncé is one of our most sophisticated, our most visually sophisticated pop stars right now, and the way she interacts with art is so incredibly fascinating and interesting.
You said that she is recontextualizing classical Western art, and I kind of thought of it more as sort of a reverse appropriation, because we're always talking about the reappropriation of African-American art, African-American culture in the larger culture, and it just seems like she's like, yeah, it cuts both ways.
Yeah, it's sort of like this is the art of a culture that spread itself across the world, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of other cultures taking images from the West, from Europe, Europe was kind of like, okay, everyone, here's this image. This is the way it's supposed to be. You got to take it. But it never centers other people, right? It almost always centers white people. So this is Beyoncé sort of saying, I'm going to take this imagery that stands for incredible wealth, incredible power, both political power, social capital, and colonialism, and I am going to make myself the center of it. I am going to become the object of this intense aesthetic attention that we have sort of deified as the most beautiful and most important way to think about images.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, our conversation is inspired by the new music put forth and the accompanying video, the message that sends by the hip-hop power couple Beyonce and Jay-Z. We'll have a link to the YouTube video on our website at WOSU.org if you wonder what in the heck we're talking about. It's filmed at the famed Louvre in Paris. The video features Beyonce among lines of black dancers moving through the galleries of masterpieces featuring, surprise, surprise, white people. My guest is Constance Grady. She's a culture writer for Vox. She's written about the her impressions of this and what they mean and what they say about Beyonce and Jay-Z to a certain extent, I suppose. If you have a question or comment, have you seen the video? What do you think? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, I was wondering, Beyonce could have done this herself. Did she need Jay-Z?
I think that Jay-Z is important for the larger context of this album. It's kind of the concluding volume in a trilogy about their marriage, right? In 2016, Beyonce releases Lemonade, which seems to say they've obviously never confirmed this in public, but it seems to accuse Jay-Z of cheating on her. And being unfaithful to their marriage. Then Jay-Z last year releases his album 444, which is him sort of confirming that, saying, yes, I cheated, I messed up, I need to make up for it. And this is the concluding volume in that trilogy where it's both of them together, united, saying, we've gotten through this rough patch, our marriage is stronger than ever, and we are a team now.
Going back to what you said about how Beyonce is recontextualizing classical Western art, you said she's making herself the aesthetic object on which so much wealth and cultural capital has been spent. And you said that coming from a black woman, that's a radical statement. It continues to be a radical statement, you think?
I think absolutely it does. I think this is something that a lot of artists of color have been working on in the fine arts field. It's something that you see with the presidential portraits that just got unveiled for the Obamas. Kehinde Wiley, who painted Barack Obama's portrait, has made part of his work is taking these iconic images from classical European art and replacing them with people of color. You know, you'll get a portrait of Napoleon with a black man instead of Napoleon. He does work like that. And I think that's become one of the most interesting and fruitful ways to engage with portraiture, which has been kind of considered stale and middle brow. That's come up in this century.
An art historian called Beyonce's blackness a kind of weapon. Who is this weapon pointed at? What kind of impact does their presence of Beyonce and Jay-Z in a place like the Louvre, what kind of impact does it have on the viewer?
I think it's less a weapon pointed at someone and more a weapon pointed for someone.
Huh.
I think it is on behalf of other black people. You know, in this video, it's not just Beyonce who's taking on the poses of these sculptures. You know, she's becoming the Venus de Milo and she's becoming the Greek goddess of victory, Nike. But she also is surrounded by other black people who are reenacting these poses that you see in the portraits all around you. It's becoming not just Beyonce herself who is the object of this attention, but black people in general asserting themselves as worthy of aesthetic attention.
It really does draw attention to the fact, though, of the paucity of diversity in the Louvre, in a place like that or in almost anywhere of that stature or in any big city in the world.
Yeah, and it's not that there aren't images of black people in European art, because there are. You know, people have been moving back and forth between Europe and Africa for a really, really long time. But it's pretty rare for Western art from before the late 19th, early 20th century to treat black people as the central figure in a portrait or in a tableau. A lot of times black people get relegated to being slaves or servants in those kinds of artworks.
You know, that same arts historian said that people of color were not deemed worthy subjects from the Middle Ages up to the 19th century. During that period, really, though, most artists, they worked for benefactors of great wealth. They were commissioned to do a lot of what they did.
That's true. But, you know, that's part of what makes art such a productive way of thinking about power, right? Mm-hmm. Because it is, art is the product and result of wealth. Whoever has the power and cultural capital and literal capital wealth to create art gets to decide what is appearing in that artwork. And now Beyoncé is that person, which is part of why one of the recurring lyrics in the song is, I can't believe we made it, right? Yeah. She's now made it to the point of being able to make this incredible art that 44 million people are going to see.
You know, it raises the issue. I know in one of the articles I read about them in terms of this video, that they are great art collectors, which doesn't surprise me. They're billionaires, and that's what really, really rich people do, is collect great, fabulous art. Wouldn't you love to see their collection?
Oh, absolutely. But they are incredibly private figures, which
right.
is kind of weird to say about people who just made three different albums about their marriage.
Right.
But they're both very into the idea that they will control completely the way that they share their lives with the public. You know, Beyoncé hasn't given an interview in years. I think at one point she let her sister Solange interview her for a magazine, but that's it. She just puts stuff on her social media, she releases music, and that's our only access to her. So we're definitely not going to see any of their private collection unless they decide they want to do it.
And, you know, it was $17,000 to rent the Louvre for this, but $17,000 and some change, but which is literally pocket change to them. But I'm imagining that there was also some fame involved in all this.
Yeah, part of the reason that it is relatively cheap to shoot at the Louvre is that it's good advertising for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of movies have scenes in the Louvre. 50 Shades of Grey has a scene in the Louvre, because that is a way of keeping the museum and the public in the public consciousness as the place with all of the great art. But it kind of works both ways, right? Because when the Louvre shows up in this video, it's reminding everyone that it exists and it's filled with great art, and it's sort of Beyoncé lending her fame to the Louvre. But then it's also the Louvre lending its enormous cultural prestige as the place where the Mona Lisa exists to Beyoncé.
Even though the Mona Lisa could fit practically in the palm of her hand. You know, what do you think the ultimate impact of this could be of this? I know everything's very incremental, but are people getting the message?
I think that what is so great about Beyoncé's work is that it makes people feel strong and fierce and empowered, and it's specifically built to give that feeling to people of color who mm-hmm. don't necessarily get that a lot from the rest of our culture. I think it's less about the immediate impact of this particular video and more about the way it can make people feel and what it can inspire them to do on their own.
Constance Grady, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Constance Grady is a culture writer for The Vox. She wrote about the new video that he accompanies the Everything Is Love album from Beyoncé and Jay-Z. We'll have a link to the video on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to listen to it, if you want to watch it. We're going to consider more deeply this issue of the great white Western spaces of art and how that might be changing right here in Columbus at the Wexner Center for the Arts and the Columbus Art Museum. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about a video that accompanies the Everything Is Love album from Beyoncé and Jay-Z. The setting is the famed Louvre in Paris. The super rich, super powerful couple show people of color dancing through the galleries in stark contrast to the white or mostly white subjects of the masterpieces. Just as striking is the absence of color among visitors to most Western art spaces. Treva Lindsay teaches African-American women's history and specializes in Black popular and expressive culture at Ohio State. She joins us now. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
And also joining us is curator of contemporary art at the Columbus Museum of Art, Tyler Kam. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
And senior curator of exhibitions at the Wexner Center for the Arts at OSU, Michael Goodson. Welcome.
Thank you.
What was your initial reaction to the music video? I've watched it several times now, so it's hard to remember what my initial reaction was. But what do you think, Professor Lindsay?
Well, I was once again surprised because Beyonce and Jay-Z apparently love to surprise us and drop
things,
another particularly
surprise,
Beyonce,
right, yeah.
That they would have a new piece of art and that in the middle of a tour, their joint tour, after already having started, that they were releasing new music and not just this project, but the video itself, but an entire project that was their first collaborative project in its entirety here. And so to set that up in the Louvre, to have these dancers, to have these images, to have this costuming, to have so many striking visuals, and a song, frankly, where they're just talking a lot of mess, let's be frank,
right,
about who they are, the kind of flaunting, the kind of arrogance.
Look at us.
Was an interesting kind of sonic and visual contrast to process. So I actually turned down the sonic part of it and just watched the visuals to take that in and then listen to the song itself. And they're two very different texts for me. And I am more impressed with the visual, quite honestly. But I think that the combination of the two shows something not only about their collaboration as individual artists, but also what they've accomplished as two of the most successful pop culture entertainers of probably the last 25 years.
Right. She has been doing this tableau sort of expression of her art for a while now. I mean, she's good at it.
Yes, she's quite good at it. But it's interesting for me because I think about the art references now that you see more commonly even in Jay-Z's lyrics, huh, that he's been doing a considerable amount of lyrical exploration in terms of art, whether it's Picasso, Basquiat. You hear a lot of that in his music. You see both of them attending Art Basel. So you see the art world showing up much more in their work, and particularly for Jay-Z. And although I think Beyonce is doing something similar, mm-hmm, to see where they meet in,
yeah,
terms of their interest or investment or exploration of art is quite fascinating with a video like this.
I asked the Vox writer, wouldn't you love to see their personal collection sometime, someday, maybe somewhere? Who knows? Tyler Kahn, what do you make of it? From, you know, your perspective as a curator.
Well, I mean, it's spectacular, cinematic sort of video. I think it's important for listeners to understand what the Louvre is. It's not, of course, it is a museum. It's a gigantic museum,
right,
in the center of Paris, holding 380,000 works of art, of which, I don't know, some 38,000 are currently on display. But for between like the 14th and the late 17th century, this was the, you know, the seat of power of the French Empire. You know, this was a palace until Louis XIV,
right,
decamped to Versailles. But it was only like right after the French Revolution that it became the sort of national museum. The Assembly sort of, you know, threw open the doors so that people could come into this space, and it wasn't necessarily just reserved for the aristocracy.
Mm-hmm.
So to sort of have a video that now says, okay, here is, you know, the queen of pop and the king, I don't know, of rap, you know, certainly a statesman, you know, an aristocrat of rap, sort of there and sort of joining together, as you say, in a kind of, you know, reaffirming their vows in a sense, underneath a painting called The Coronation of Napoleon, or it's actually the full title is The Consecration of Napoleon. This is the moment where he crowns himself emperor.
Right.
But at the same time, it's the coronation of his wife, Josephine. So in that painting, he is placing the crown on her head. So it's and Beyoncé is really the protagonist, I think, of this this video with
yeah.
Jay-Z in a kind of supporting role.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite interesting the way they sort of play off one another.
I can't even imagine being curators what you get out of it. That you know the most of us and never will, because you immediately see the significance in the works of art that, you know, an average person might not. Michael, what did you make of it?
I was really initially taken aback by the largesse of the gesture, which seemed to make a kind of sense to me.
Well, it's very Beyoncé, though.
Yeah, and their presence in the art world at Art Basel and as collectors for people who are in the art world has been known for a while. So it made a kind of sense in that way. And I think visually they made all the right decisions. I've been kind of trying to figure out how the choices they made is codified. And it's an interest. I'd need to watch the video
more.
What do
you mean codified?
I think they made some conscious decisions as to what they would be filmed in front of.
Yes.
And it's all part of, again, the sort of almost the largesse of the video, which is consciously done. And I think it's also a beautiful video. So it's directed by Ava DuVernay, who directed Selma.
I didn't know that. Okay, yeah.
And they made that choice, who is a real, really has the reins on the video in terms of visually how it operates.
Yeah.
I do have this other thought about it, though, which is to say that in terms of how people of color are now operating and their ideas are operating in the art world, the contemporary art world. I mean, I think this is a gaze at history, which makes a kind of sense given the gaze that Beyoncé gave us with Lemonade, which kind of operated amid a lot of contemporary art and some of the tropes of contemporary art. This is a kind of gaze into history,
uh-huh.
if you will. But I think it's potentially a truncated way to think about people of color in contemporary art. You know what I mean? Like it's there's a lot of ideas and a lot of artists with different ideas, and there's a huge conversation to be had about this that doesn't all emanate from what Jay-Z and Beyoncé are doing. That's the ancillary thought that I had about
okay.
all of this.
I think that's an interesting. That's a really interesting. There's just a huge culture out there that goes way beyond, and would probably they would shrink in the midst of it if they were exposed to it at once.
I mean, I think what's signaled there is there's an incredible body of art. Being in the Louvre and being in front of the works that they're in front of, there is a commentary on empire. And
yeah.
there's often this thing of framing B and J as king, queen of et cetera, et cetera. And even B being King B. Like that's a framing of this. And so to use something that's at the seat of empire, that literally was at this kind of questioning of power and all of the contradictions and problems that come with the problem of empire, right? Who are your loyal subjects? How do you make them loyal? What are the consequences of empire?
Yeah, right.
All of that is in that commentary as well. So there's something to be said for this interesting fascination that both of them have with these what have been historically white and European spaces that are colonizing spaces, that are imperial spaces, versus perhaps setting up in the Studio Museum in Harlem as a different kind of choice and highlighting that. And I think that that's in one way about a fetishization that we have of what those spaces mean and access to those spaces mean. There's a way that you say we shot something in the Louvre and you're like, oh, wow.
Yeah, right.
That resonates.
It's not that expensive,
right.
by the way.
Right. I was actually surprised by the price in reading that. But what would it mean to shoot a video like this and highlight New York street art or highlight different kinds of artists that we don't know yet, that they can be culture breakers and brokers as opposed to kind of people who have access to a space that other people don't have access to. But there have been trafficking in this for a while. Jay literally calls Beyoncé the modern day Mona Lisa, and they have this shot in front of the Mona Lisa. What is it to mean to say that it has to be modern day to frame her in that way?
Yeah.
That Black women's beauty is something that is modern and only recognized in a contemporary context as opposed to any number of artists that precede this moment and that are now still creating to show a longer trajectory of people of color in the art world that have created their own art worlds. Mm-hmm.
Unto themselves, right.
I find it fascinating that, you know, in terms of their choices of what to be depicted against, yes, there is one or two shots in front of an Egyptian piece, the Sphinx of Tanis. Mm-hmm. But predominantly, it is from the period of the French Revolution and a lot of neoclassical sort of history painting by Jacques-Louis David.
You think it's just stuff they like?
Well, this is a moment of, you know, radical transformation in French society. And, well, you know, David himself was a part of the revolution, but he also kind of came back and, you know, painted for Napoleon, crowning himself emperor, you know, that same painting. Mm-hmm. But there's kind of a shift there. I mean, there's some classical works. There's, of course, the Winged Victory of Samothrace. There's, you know, the Venus de Milo. You know, a goddess of love. And of course, Beyoncé is right there, you know, being framed as a goddess. But when Jay-Z's, you know, his there's kind of a break in the middle of the, there's a sort of a moment of silence, after which it picks up really with Jay-Z more. Mm-hmm. And he is in front of a work by Theodore Géricault called The Raft of the Medusa, which is, you know, it directly invokes the Middle Passage as well. You know, this is a French ship that is, you know, ran aground off the coast of West Africa. You know, the captain and the crew abandoned ship, basically leaving all these passengers to kind of fend for themselves. And the painting depicts, there's sort of a close-up of this in the video, a man waving a kind of tattered banner to attract a passing ship. And that man was, we know his name, Jean-Charles, and he was an African sailor. Likewise, there's, you know, other sort of Renaissance paintings, and there's some close-ups there of, you know, African servants at the, you know, the wedding feast of Cana by a Renaissance painter. So just those sorts of choices, in some ways, provides a kind of undercurrent to the statement about, you know, a kind of arrival in this, you know, historically, you know, seat of European power, that suggests some of the contemporary sort of issues, some instability with that arrival. There's a kind of acknowledgement of contemporary issues of, you know, state violence against black people even. Mm-hmm. So I just thought that was quite interesting that there is, you know, you've got the camera turning several times too, right, sort of upside down. And it made me think, is this the seat of power shifting, or is this a sort of instability to that sense of, you know, new power and having a seat at the very top of the table now,
right,
with Beyoncé and Jay-Z?
Yeah.
And I think that all that is to say that the choices were definitive, and there was an intentionality to all of it. I think it's a kind of an incredible piece of art in and of itself.
Exactly.
In that regard. But, you know, a lot of it for me emanates from a very interesting piece of work by Faith Ringgold, a tapestry, a quilt actually called Dancing in the Louvre. Mm-hmm. And I can't help but think that piece is really the beginning of this entire endeavor in a funny way.
Is it in the...
No.
It's not in it. It's just you're thinking that...
It's the first thing that I thought of when I started watching the video in preparation for this conversation over and over again yesterday.
Yeah.
I think we've all seen it several times now.
Exactly. We are talking about the new Beyoncé and Jay-Z video. It's out there. It's part of their new album. It came out surprised everybody, which is not unusual for them. If you have a question or comment, what did you think of the video? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And what do you think it says about the place, the Louvre, and just Western art spaces in general and the whiteness of them. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. I want to turn to that issue that I get what you're saying, that it's about something more than whether or not people visit art galleries or art museums, mm-hmm. but there is an issue. I mean, you go to them and it's there. Treva, Lindsay, I mean, what do you think about that? I mean, is there, even if that wasn't what their message was, it was more about power and the place of power and maybe the turning canders and the reversal of power.
Right. Absolutely. I think there are a lot of important conversations right now happening around accessibility, inclusion, et cetera, around museums and art spaces. And I think these are really important conversations. I think the Columbus Museum of Art and the Wexner are places that are really out in front of these conversations and thinking about what kind of exhibitions are there, what kind of artists are we featuring, how are we curating these spaces, how are we talking about identity and art. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and so I had the access to the Free Smithsonian.
Yeah.
And so I never knew that everybody didn't go to museums because it was a consistent thing. But one of the ones we didn't go to as much was the portrait gallery and the art gallery. That was actually probably the least exciting one that was pitched to us
old
as students
men.
There. And it's interesting to see right now with the paintings of both former President Obama and Michelle Obama, the kind of fear that you're seeing people entering into the portrait gallery, which tells you, like we've seen in so many other cultural spaces, when people see themselves mirrored back, when they see artists and connect to artists and art that reflects their experiences, that reflects the artist's identity, different things like that, you bring different people into the space. Mm. And so I think that showing the Louvre and having this moment where you see these people not just going to the Louvre, but shutting down the Louvre, right? You can rent it if you want to for several thousands of dollars and be there and have events. But shutting it down and having this intentional dialogue with the pieces that are there and choices also shows, like, these are not just choices that were made because they're pretty or they're powerful, but have these stories. And I think that shows a knowledge and an engagement with art that I do think prompts certain conversations about how we teach art and the importance of teaching these broad and complicated histories of art and bringing people into that conversation.
Yeah.
And there are these overarching ideas of reclamation and ownership that take place within this conversation. That's really, in a funny way, the most interesting part of it for me.
Yeah.
It's the thing that drives it. And the thing that makes looking at all these artists now that are being given their due really interesting for me. I can talk about it as a curator a mm-hmm. little bit, which is to say that if I were to go back a couple years, I received this funny email from a colleague who essentially was reminding me that she had looked at my trajectory as a curator and reminded me that there were not enough women being shown. And my first reaction to that was to get a little angry. Like, I didn't think of myself as that curator or that person. But when I really looked at it, she was right. And so there was this conscious effort then to look at women more. And I think the same thing has occurred over the last 5-7 years for me to look at artists of color more. Because intrinsically, I think that I might not give them the attention that they need and deserve. So there's been a conscious effort. And now it's been folded seamlessly into the way I think, which is kind of great. So in our current show at the Wexner Center, we have artists like Eric Mack, Stanley Whitney, Kevin Beasley, and they enrich everything. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. It's good.
It's really
more is better.
It's really good. And it's not and it's beyond being consciously inclusive, although that's part of it. It's just smart, good art that addresses what's going on in culture right now. It's really art as culture.
I'm going to take a quick break. We're going to get right back to this. That's Tyler Kann. He's curator of contemporary art at the Columbus Museum. I'm sorry, Michael Goodson, senior curator of exhibitions for the Wexner Center for the Arts. Also with us, Dr. Treva Lindsay, professor of African-American women's history for Ohio State University, and Tyler Kann, curator of contemporary art for the Columbus Museum of Art. So join us. Come back. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about who you see when you visit an art museum, an art space, anything from the Columbus Museum of Art to the Wexner Center for the Arts to the Museum of Modern Art in New York or the Louvre in Paris, where Beyoncé and Jay-Z filmed a video for their joint album, Everything is Love. The video now famously contrasts the whiteness of subjects in the masterpieces with a troupe of magnificent dancers of color. Tableaus and whatnot. The message of the inclusivity versus exclusivity of these spaces has us talking. Still with us, OSU professor Treva Lindsay. She teaches African-American women's history and specializes in Black popular and expressive culture. Also with us, curator of contemporary art at the Columbus Museum of Art, Tyler Kann, and senior curator of exhibitions at the Wexner Center for the Arts, Michael Goodson. What do you think? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Tyler Kann, you wanted to say something right when we were taking a break.
I think all of us, hopefully responsible people working at cultural institutions are sort of rethinking the history of those institutions and their, legacy of sort of exclusion, and trying to reorient the museum toward being a more inclusive and accessible space.
And it's not too late.
It's never too late. It's never finished, really. And I think the Louvre itself is, I'm sure they had a lot to gain by being seen in this video as well. Mm-hmm. This was not just a sort of one-sided, takeover of a space. And this is also the Louvre saying, yes, we want to be associated absolutely. Mm-hmm.
With the richest entertainers in the world. Yeah.
Yes. So
not just rich, but powerful. When I say rich, I think more than just billions of dollars, but power.
Exactly. I mean, they can definitely move the cultural needle.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Columbus, in our own way, we are trying to do this. We're trying quite hard to become a more diverse and inclusive space and create conversations around that.
So part of it's what's hanging on the walls or resting on the pedestal, so to speak. But the other part of it is just opening the doors and finding the people to bring them in.
That's part of it. I think it's more complex than that, though. It's also about the way these spaces are marketed and the way we kind of design the experience, the space itself, certainly, but also the experience of the space to be more inclusive. And I don't mean more inclusive for one or two shows where it seems a good fit to be more inclusive, but a kind of inclusivity that is ongoing. How does an institution rethink itself in that way? It's a really complicated issue. I can tell you that. So this fall, Lucy Zimmerman at the Wexner Center and I are curating a kind of a massive exhibition of the work of Micheline Thomas that interestingly comes from an idea that Micheline herself sort of gave to us, which is to say an exploration of her collaborative relationship with the women that she calls her muses, which would include her mother and herself. this has been an incredible undertaking, not only in terms of curating the exhibition, choosing works, thinking about how the works operate together. For me, it's a very much a painting show and a celebration of both the history of painting and Micheline Thomas's take on the history
of
painting.
Tell us about Micheline Thomas and who she is.
Micheline Thomas is an African-American woman artist who has made a career of essentially inverting the gaze. So looking at the way that Western art history and the canon of Western art has both depicted women and also bodies of color, and kind of taking it in a very personal way and making a vocabulary out of it that includes intimate relationships with the people who are her sitters, essentially. And they're ongoing relationships, and they're relationships that endure through sickness and in health, and they're real relationships. Kind of an anathema to the way the gaze has operated throughout art history in a funny way. And they're also stunning objects, which I think is kind of an interesting part of her vocabulary because really in a funny way what she's doing is luring the viewer in with these incredibly made objects that involve dances of color and acrylic paint, a mastery with acrylic paint and rhinestones and scale. But really what she's talking about is a multi-layered exploration of what it is to look at the body of color and to place the body of color in the context of the museum. And Micheline Thomas is doing this in a really exemplary way because she is in museums across this country as we speak. And we're really happy to have her this fall, both in the museum and she's also our residency artist, so there'll be a special project within the exhibition itself and a performance with the jazz drummer Terry Lynn Carrington, all of which explores this history that's fraught with essentially bad ideas and conflict. And she turns it on its ear, and it's the thing that I was drawn to in her work. And really I'm drawn to her in her as a person. She's an incredibly strong woman.
How old is she?
I would put Micheline at about 40.
Well, she's young.
Yeah, she's young.
She's a fairly young artist.
I think she is.
That's fairly young.
Yeah. Well, that just dates me, I suppose.
She's a kid.
Yeah, she's a spring chicken.
But in doing that, I guess the other point here was in doing that show this fall, one of the things that the Wexner Center immediately thought to do and had saw as our responsibility is to think about how we make this the beginning of a kind of inclusivity that hopefully we can carry through shows. Even though there is a hairpin turn between Micheline Thomas in the fall and John Waters of all people following that, that's a tricky thing to navigate. But in doing our work, our due diligence for the Micheline Thomas show in the fall, we have gathered a group of community voices from the Shoemake Council and from largely the voices of African-American women to talk about how we present this show and how we market it to the public and how we make it as inclusive as
possible. And of course, with Micheline, it's not just racial diversity. It's also sexual diversity. And that's something that we're, you know, also happen to be looking at in the fall as well with two exhibitions. One is the one Isaac Julian. It's called Looking for Langston, and it's a sort of a film and a series of photographs that look at this this figure of Langston Hughes, but very much through the lens of his homosexuality. And at the same time, we have a major exhibition called I Too Sing America, the Harlem Renaissance at 100. Celebrating the 100-year sort of anniversary
in Columbus, Ohio.
The Harlem Renaissance. Yeah. Yes, which of course extended, was not just in Harlem or New York, but extended across the country. So, and that's curated by, we have a guest curator, Will Haygood, who is from Columbus.
The prolific writer from
we're working
Columbus.
With. And we're also working with Professor Treva Lindsay as well on a space that we are, the sort of working title is the Experimental Annex. And this is a space upstairs. There'll be a place where we are involving artists from Columbus to reflect on the history and to sort of create some conversations around some very large questions, which I think Treva can talk about as well.
Sure. I mean, I think with both of these exhibitions or the three of these exhibitions really highlight is being unafraid and brave to take on the challenge of history, to take on the challenge of what has been problematic, to be brave about approaching conflict. We often talk about safe space at universities and campuses. And what I think a lot of this work is about creating brave space where it is difficult. Our difficult dialogue should be difficult. If they've gotten easy, then we're not mm-hmm. getting at the question anymore. Mm-hmm. We're not getting at the core thing. And I think these offer an opportunity to do some self-reflexive work and open up to communities, multiple communities who are invested in that, people who always come to shows, people who this will be their first show that they're going to, that you create space for people to begin that dialogue and to be honest about what that position has been prior to this moment. And mm-hmm. I think that's really helpful in the experimental annex, our tentative title. I know we're thinking a lot about themes of conflict, of identity, of upheaval, of creativity and in the many ways that it comes through, of thinking about gender and sexuality in these spaces in unique ways. And I think it's important to engage contemporary artists who are thinking about this, creating a space where the community becomes not just a participant, but also very active in the space and engage in this. And I think these conversations that we can have with artists, these conversations that we can have with each other about what it means that there was this renaissance, there mm-hmm. was this period that in many ways produces some of the most amazing art of the 20th century, but it's also marked by incredible violence and incredible government repression and an economic crisis, ultimately, and wars. I mean, really powerful and damaging political and historical moments, but you also get some of the most amazing creativity that comes out of that. And I think it's really important to think about where creativity emerges from and how creativity can be so important in really dire times. Mm-hmm. And I think and can respond to some of our most profound questions that we sometimes feel so perplexed and overwhelmed by, that expressivity and art specifically gives us a vehicle to be able to do some of that processing and do some of that work. And I think we can really pitch that to communities that are looking for answers in times of incredible distress, that art actually provides something substantive, not just ethereal, not intangible, something very tangible, something very real and material that they can hold on to and imagine with.
I just wanted to turn to Michelle in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just really enjoying the conversation. I'm a gallerist in the Short North, and this is a topic that's been on my mind for several years and read a lot about it. I did want to bring it down to, you know, the institutions and what have you, both internationally and nationally, are having this conversation. But we as gallerists in the community are having this conversation as well. So we have taken a concerted effort to look at our representation of artists that we show. We're participating in the 100-year anniversary of the Harlem Renaissance, so all of the galleries in the Short North in August will be featuring Black contemporary artists from Columbus. And so it's really important for us to bring to our audiences and our collectors a broader range of what typically has been shown in the Short North, to be quite honest. We all had to take a really hard look at the artists that we were showing, and there are some unbelievable artists working here in Columbus, Omar Shahid, Antoinette Savage, Joe Howard, and so all of these Black contemporary artists will be shown in the Short North in August. And then I think what's important for us as gallerists as well is that, you know, it's just not a month-long kind of thing, that we sort of look at this more in terms of, you know, representing these artists in perpetuity or having more shows that reflect, a broader range of artists working in our community. Or
Michelle, I could listen to you all day. I mean, this is a great topic. Thank you so much for your call. Yes, we will be doing a deeper dive into the Harlem Renaissance Anniversary exhibitions coming up in August and throughout the year. So we'll be doing that. For now, I have to say thank you for joining us again, Dr. Treva Lindsay. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Treva Lindsay, professor of African-American women's history for The Ohio State University. Also, Tyler Kann, curator of contemporary art at the Columbus Museum of Art. Thanks for joining us again. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, and I hope your listeners will come see our current show, A Measure of Humanity, as well. It's fantastic.
Michael Goodson, senior curator of exhibitions for Wexner Center for the Arts. Thanks to you as well. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks, Anne. Appreciate it.
Thanks to the All-Side staff. Producer Mary Lee Williams, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, All Sides interns Martin Coleman, Alexander Havolchik, Scott Good, and Ray Brewster, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Be sure to like us on Facebook, follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me too at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.